We wanted to give a little extra time because, as you know, it's not always easy to get into Van Pelt Library and the elevators can be slow, but I think that we need to start our program. And I'd very much like to wish you, as chair of the Lorraine Beitler Dreyfus Collection Advisory Committee, it's my pleasure to welcome you all here this evening for our forum on Democracy Today, Lessons from Dreyfus and Zola. I'd also like to extend a particular welcome to Rabbi Aaron Landis, who is with us tonight. And among his many attributes, Rabbi Landis is the only rabbi to hold the rank of Rear Admiral, now retired, but Rear Admiral in the U.S. Naval Reserve. So it's nice to have a representative of the armed services here in the context of something to do with the Dreyfus affair. We're privileged indeed tonight to have the participation of two distinguished scholars, Professor Jean-Marc Ségur from Georgetown University and Professor Jeffrey Mailman from Boston University, who will be sharing with us some of the fruits of their own research on the Dreyfus affair and its ramifications. I know that these presentations will stimulate your questions and discussion of the issues they raise. In an era when democracy is under siege, both at home and abroad, the lessons that can be drawn from the Dreyfus affair are particularly relevant and of the utmost importance. Now, one of the reasons we're here this evening is thanks to the courage and zeal of a great French writer, Émile Zola. And I wanted to take this opportunity to remind you that this year marks the 100th anniversary of the ceremony in which Zola's remains were transferred to the Pantheon in Paris, which is the ultimate compliment France can give to its great men and women. So I just wanted to remind you of that anniversary coming up this June, and in fact Lorraine Beitler herself will be there representing us at this ceremony. And speaking of Lorraine, I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank a number of people. And first and foremost is, of course, Dr. Lorraine Beitler, whose tireless work on promoting the continued importance of the Dreyfus affair in our modern world is an inspiration to us all. Secondly, I want to thank the members of the advisory committee who give so freely of their time and expertise to this important cause. Thirdly, I'd like to thank Dr. Carton Rogers, Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, who once again has extended us the hospitality of the Van Pelt Library, and whose talented and energetic staff, in particular John Pollock, Lynn Farrington, and David McKnight, have made this evening's event possible. So before passing microphone to David McKnight, who will introduce our moderator this evening, Jermaine Ingram, I would like to remind you that we do have, once the presentations, discussions, and so on are over, an exhibition in the Lee Library, which is, as you probably already know, behind the glass doors, right behind you, of various artifacts and pictures from the collection that Lorraine has so graciously given to the University of Pennsylvania. So without further ado, let me hand over to David. Thank you for coming tonight, and we welcome you.
Thank you very much, Lance. I would just like to extend, again, a welcome on behalf of Carton Rogers, who's traveling today and is unfortunately out of town. Welcome to Penn Libraries. Welcome to the Rare Books and Manuscript Library. I'd just like to note, this is a personal note, this is my second anniversary at Penn. I arrived here in precisely on April 3rd, 2006. And among the pleasures that I had when I came to Penn was to be introduced to the Lorraine Beitler Collection of the Dreyfus Affair. And this has been a formative experience working with Lorraine and the members of the committee and the collection itself. So I'm quite honored to be here this evening with you and working on the collection. It's my honor to introduce our moderator this evening, Jermaine Ingram, who has dedicated her life to serving children, particularly those in the Philadelphia area. For years, she served as general counsel and then deputy superintendent of the school district of Philadelphia, working to ensure a high-quality education for all children. Jermaine focused especially on achieving scale so that the model programs could be expanded to serve those beyond the experimental group. She also fought to retain funding for arts, music, and other enrichment programs, understanding that these were essential, not peripheral, aspects of a high-quality education. After leaving the school district, Germaine served as vice president for the Black Community Crusade for Children of the Children's Defense Fund. Germaine actually established this national initiative to support African-American children throughout the United States. Germaine then returned to Philadelphia, seeking to attend to unfinished business in education. Since her return to Philadelphia, Germaine has been a key player in several initiatives that affect children. She is a mainstay of the Picasso Project, operating under the auspices of the PCCY. Her role on the board has been critical in drawing attention and resources to funding arts projects for children. Germaine has also played a major role as board member and longtime president of the Philadelphia Folklore Project, which too has worked to bring arts and culture to the Philadelphia community, particularly for children. When the William Penn Foundation tapped the Philadelphia Education Fund to develop an initiative to engage the public in public education, PEF reached out to Germaine to launch and oversee that initiative. Currently, Germaine is involved in several projects dedicated to creating community linkages so that children in struggling communities are embraced by a network that nurtures, educates, and leads to an environment of significant opportunities matched with high expectations for the community and the children served. Germaine Ingram was born and raised in Philadelphia, attended Philadelphia public schools, graduating from the Philadelphia High School for Girls. She received her BA from Syracuse University and her JD from the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Ingram was a fellow in law and humanities at Harvard and holds an honorary doctorate degree from Rosemont College. In 2007, Ingram was awarded the Friend to Children Award by the Please Touch Museum. Finally, without including that distinguished past and present, she also is a professional tap dancer and choreographer. She has performed and had her pieces presented nationally and internationally. And I give the floor over to Germaine Ingram.
Well, after sitting through that long introduction, you're entitled to a dance. I'm looking forward to a really lively conversation today with our two distinguished guests. And I'm going to, I have the honor of introducing them, fortunately, in briefer way than I was introduced. And I'm going to introduce them both at the same time in the interest of time, and they will just come up in order. Professor Jean-Max Gueux is a native of Provence, where he earned degrees in French language and literature and minored in phonetics and linguistics. He came to the United States, where he received his PhD in 1968 from the University of Maryland. Since 1977, he has been a very active member of the academic community at Georgetown University. He's been an incredibly prolific writer. He's been a member of the Faculty Senate, of University Senate at Georgetown University. He serves in the School of Foreign Service, on that school's executive committee, on the school's Standards and Curriculum Committee. And he's been also very instrumental in developing the overseas exchange program for the school with Paris and University of Lyon. He has led many study tours with the Smithsonian Associates and the National Trust for Historical Preservation. Another indication of his civic commitment is that he's an AIDS volunteer working with AIDS patients in DC clinics. He is a renowned expert scholar on Zola and on the Dreyfus case. He has developed a comprehensive bibliography of the Dreyfus case. That bibliography contains over 5,000 fully searchable items that are displayed on CD-ROM. He is also translated Jacques and organized an important, really important centennial celebration of that publication in 1998. Our other speaker today, Professor Jeffrey Mailman, is a literary critic and historian of ideas. Over a number of years, he has been writing an implicit history of speculative interpretation in France in the form of a series of readings of canonical literary works. He has also written extensively, published many books on anti-Semitism, essays, one book in 1993 titled Walter Benjamin for Children, an essay on his radio years. Emigre, New York, French Intellectuals in Wartime Manhattan, 1940 to 1944, which was published in 2000. He has done extensive translations, beginning with his collection French Freud, published in 1973, which has played an important role in the naturalization of French thought in English. In 1994, he was appointed officer of the Ordre de Paume Académique by the French government. So please welcome our first speaker, Professor Jean-Max Guy.
I would like also to thank the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, the Beitler Foundation Advisory Committee, Lance, Donaldson Evans, and John Pollack, and of course, Lauren Beitler for inviting me. It is a rare privilege for me to be part of this program because I know how much involved they are in keeping the flame for the defense of human rights, as obviously Emile Zola was when he entered the Dreyfus case. And I hope you will understand my accent. When, like Jeffrey Mailman and I, one has been working on Alfred Dreyfus and Emile Zola for several years, there are many instances in the daily news when current events seem to echo some others which happened more than 100 years ago during the Dreyfus affair. And I'm not here just referring and thinking to the fate of President Félix IV, the one to whom Émile Zola had written his open letter, better known as J'accuse, when he was found having oral sex performed in his office in a very unfortunate way. It could be, for instance, in 1994, during the O.J. Simpson's trial, when people dared wondering if it was credible that prosecution detectives could have been planting some evidence in order to assure a guilty verdict. Or in 1999 in Los Alamos, when an Asian scientist named Wen Ho Lee was assumed to be a spy in a typical racial profiling indictment. These echoes can be more recent. 2 years after Dreyfus' condemnation, Lieutenant Colonel Picard, by then head of the French intelligence services, went to his superiors and told them that they had framed a wrong spy, and therefore an innocent man was now unjustly detained on Devil's Island. But the reaction of General Gons was similar to that of Vice President Cheney. He said, "So?" I was also reminded of Dreyfus' case just last Sunday when on 60 Minutes, Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish-German who had been a detainee at Guantanamo, spoke about his long detention before being eventually cleared up of all charges. He then mentioned the title of his book, 5 Years in My Life, which is precisely the title of Captain Dreyfus's memoirs detailing his own ordeal for 5 years. But these examples are just trivia moments of history repeating itself, for there are more serious issues at stake. Yes, we are in a different context, in a different time, but we can see how human nature and political schemes have not changed much. We can witness the fact that the erosion of memories dealing with acts of intolerance during the Dreyfus case paved the way for even more frightening examples of barbarism, such as our 20th century genocides. Yes, indeed, my practice of the Dreyfus affair and the legacy of Zola is affecting my vision of the challenges facing democracy today. The first concern I have is the discrepancy then and now, and in both the French and the American system, between civil justice and military justice. If you remember, the French army was able to prosecute Dreyfus on charges using secret evidences which were not even transmitted to his civilian lawyer. The French intelligence was allowed to refuse divulgating any of the classified documents, arguing that if he would do so, it would pose an imminent danger to its secret services if they would expose their agent, let someone else evaluate the validity of their sources of information, or even reveal the methods used in procuring them. This very legal military precaution had been made even more stringent after the unthinkable, colossal disaster of the 1870 war with Prussia. Now the military, followed by a patriotic public opinion, lived in the paranoia of having German spies lurking after every French move in the name of national homeland security. We can follow, then as we may now, the ultra-secretive and intricate legal complications of trials involving intelligence cases, such as the one of Captain Dreyfus, how the military could justify his sleep deprivation during this investigation, or his solitary confinement with iron shackles in miserable conditions in a remote island in the middle of a tropical nowhere. I do not want to elaborate this point because we all know the process which justifies today, through the same military justice arguments, the special juridical treatment of the detainees of Guantanamo. The second concern I have is the erosion of the notion of laïcité, which in English is often referred as secularism. If you recall the 1905 law of separation of church and state in France, it was the direct result of the Dreyfus case, during which some eminent members of the Catholic Church had played a shady role. The first article of the law states, "The exercise of religion is free," and therefore, in the French Republican school system, it must be non-denominational. State-run places should be void of any ostentatious religious display, and public officials should refrain from religious references. Remember the story about the Islamic veil. Last December, President Sarkozy visited the Pope and was made an honorary canon of St. John Lateran. He gave a speech in which he declared, I quote, "It is in the interest of the Republic that there exists a moral reflection inspired by religious convictions, because secular morality always runs the risk of wearing itself out or changing into fanatism when it is not backed up by some hope aspiring to the infinite." The second article of the law proclaims, "The state neither recognizes neither subsidizes any religion." In 2006, the then Minister of the Interior, Sarkozy, commissioned a report which recommended modifying the law of 1905 in order to accommodate the demands of the Muslims of France for more mosques. In December, Michel Alliot-Marie, the previous Minister of Defense of France and now the French Minister of the Interior, declared that, I quote, she was wondering if it might be possible to turn religious associations, which cannot receive a government subsidy, into cultural associations, which can. And this is happening right now in Marseille, in Lille, in Lyon, and in Rennes, where the state is giving money to build cultural centers in which you have a large prayer room. Again, I don't need to elaborate, but behind the lip service to the French Muslims, doesn't that remind you of our faith-based initiatives with the French twist? And this is a country in which the separation of church and state is a lot more drastic than the one in the U.S. In the U.S., a nation under God, where we have noticed the revival of the religious right in everyday life, such as in education, in politics. Remember, for instance, how the Catholic Church and some evangelical congregations got openly and heavily involved during the last U.S. presidential election. Elsewhere, this mounting role of religion is not only obvious in Iran, for instance, in which we already have a theocracy, but now in Iraq as well, where civilian politicians are negotiating with clerics, and in Turkey this week, where the liberals are trying to their best to resist the anti-secular party now in power. A third issue which makes me cringe is the intensification of intolerance, the return to forces of fanaticism and exclusion. For instance, in Ukraine, visited 3 days ago by President Bush, the Western media got us all excited by the exhilarating political victory of the Orange Revolution in 2004. They edited, however, the demonstration of extreme nationalism and anti-Semitism which went on with it. Key opposition leaders, including now President Viktor Yushchenko, accepted not only the support of the US and the European Union, but welcomed also the backing of neo-Nazi groups. These politicians even defended anti-Semitic publications in which an extraordinary rant in 2003 claimed that 400,000 Jews had fought alongside Hitler's invading army, Ukraine, in 1941. Yes, as in the time of the Dreyfus case, we are entering now a period in which not only intolerance is rampant, but in which hatred has become very vocal. Like in La Libre Parole, de Pellerin, La Croix, L'Antisémitique, and Psst, those anti-diffusor papers, which were certainly not models of restraint or bon goût, or like in a Jerry Springer show of today, people bark shamelessly their anti-Arab, anti-black, anti-white, anti-Asian, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, anti-gay insults, as well as their anti-French, anti-smokers, anti-fight, fat, anti-rival soccer teams, freely. What was considered polite social graces are not only disappearing. Fanaticism, intolerance, and verbal abuse are on the rise in the name of some freedom of expression. I do a little parenthesis that I wanted to avoid, but since I have the time. Without comparing bad apples and rotten oranges, as I don't want to assimilate racism, anti-Semitism, or homophobia with anti-French sentiments, I will nevertheless stress that in my 40 years in the United States as a French person, I never was exposed to so many derogatory statements from American journalists, politicians, or diplomats in the Washington Post, for instance, or to so many insults in bar at parties than in the recent years, and with such an open and obnoxious way. The free expression of morons on serious topics has never been so vocal. Every drunk has an opinion with clichés, stereotypes, and unfounded announcements. When there are students who are making such dumb declarations, in a way I welcome the dialogue and try to do my job as an educator. But I am not able to reason or silence fanatics and bullies of every persuasion. The problem is that verbal attacks are just an opening. Given the time and the feeling of impunity, violence against Arabs, gays, blacks, Christians or Jews are multiplying all around the world. Remember Sohami Benzian in France in 2002, who was killed because she was a Muslim bitch? About Anthony Graham in the US in 2006, a black guy was dragged behind a car. Matthew Shepard in the US in 1998, or Sébastien Nouché in France in 2004, who was doused with gasoline because they were gay. Ilan Halimi, a French Jew who was killed in 2006, or Mathieu Roumi was just killed 2 weeks ago and was left dead with Jew written on his forehead with a marker. Well, then, unfortunately, there is a little indignation in the newspaper, maybe a few marches, and then we move on to the next competition of Dancing with the Stars. These aggressors can now use the airwaves to spread their venom. In December 1904, the French Council of State, the highest administrative court in France, had to ban transmissions from an Islamic radical station on the ground that some of its programs were anti-Semitic. They had, for instance, accused Israel of spreading AIDS to Arab countries. This gratuitous and abominable allegation seems to be flourishing and convincing everyone, since Pat Buchanan had already accused the gays to also give aid to heterosexuals as part of their secret gay agenda, or more recently, Reverend Wright accusing white Americans to spread the same illness among the black population. In the good old days of the Dreyfus case, it was the gypsies kidnapping children, the Freemasons plotting against law-abiding people, and the Jews, of course, poisoning the wells. It gets worse these days, as the internet can even offer anonymity to these fanatics, who now just need a computer to start their own hatred blogs, read them and find out that one doesn't even need to know how to spell or write with proper grammar to affirm the most stupid things, abuse any despised minority, or spread the vilest rumors and the wildest conspiracy theories. One might in some twisted way regret the vitriolic but literary talent of a Barrès, a Maurras, or even a Léon Daudet. Everyone is a journalist, everyone has become an editorialist, and everyone can freely spread the hate disease. If, according to a study, in 2007, 23% fewer racist incidents were reported by the French police, the number of racist, anti-Semitic, negationist, and jihadist propaganda sites has, and I quote the report, literally exploded on the internet. The wildest dreams of the anti-diffuser and anti-Semite La Libre Parole have become a worldwide cyber reality show. To give you another example, when I started working on the Dreyfus Affair ages ago, finding a copy in a library of the anti-Semitic propaganda book, Protocols of the Elders of Zion, was not really easy. Well, try surfing today on the internet. There are copies in every language ready to spread that same canard as a century ago, and with the same success in convincing more and more new morons on the international Jewish plot. What have we done since the Dreyfus case, and what can we do now? Well, mobilize, educate, organize exhibits, plan conferences, stand up and speak up, even if we are ourselves just nanoseconds in the conscience of man. And so, to help us, there are now more and more watchdogs against intolerance. In France, for instance, many laws have passed prohibiting the public expression of anti-Semitism, provocation of ethnic discrimination, and any incitation to racial hatred. Many groups, similar to the American organizations such as NABREATH, the Anti-Defamation League, Amnesty International, are now doing their best to educate, protest, and sue any breakers of those French laws. For instance, just last month, SOS Racisme, the National Movement Against Racism, the Union of Jewish Students of France, the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions of France, and the International League Against Racism and Antisemitism filed a legal action in a Paris court. It was against a US internet server which hosted the Association of Veterans Fans of Stories About Wars and Holocaust, a virulently anti-Semitic and Holocaust-denying French site, but now on an American server. Yes, if the defense of basic human and civil rights has become more global, the net is giving now an international podium as well to the fanatic bullies. A problem I also have is that men of goodwill need beniatic heroes. But where is Emile Zola in our time? Where are the Gandhis, the Arthur Millers, the Norman Mailers of today? It is a little frustrating for me to have only Jim Carrey, Susan Sarandon, or Angelina Jolie to represent to the world the face of human rights. And since I am mentioning human rights, let me in conclusion say a few words about an organization which was founded in 1898, just a few weeks after Jacques, and which is still alive and well today. It's the League for the Right of Man. As Minister of Justice in 1895, Senator Ludovic Trarieux had been able to read the files submitted to the judges during the Dreyfus court-martial of 1894. Being a lawyer, he was appalled by the many improprieties, which he called an abomination. In February 1898, Trarieux became a key defense witness in Zola's libel trial after Jacques. Following that scandalous trial, not only whistleblower Lieutenant Colonel Picard was demoted, but other witnesses were harassed or even fired from their job as civil servants, as was Edouard Grimaud, the senior professor of chemistry at the École Polytechnique, for having signed a petition in favor of a retrial for Dreyfus. This is when Trarieux founded the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, League for Rights of Man, along with Grimaud, Émile Duclos, the director of the Pasteur Institute, the Sorbonne professor Ferdinand Buisson, and writer Francis de Pressensé, who had been once the director of newspaper Le Temps. Their goal was to fight for the judicial protection of individual rights, such as the one trampled during the Dreyfus case, and for equality for all citizens under the law. Soon, from all across France, many people joined in, most of them Dreyfusards. Many were intellectuals, such as the well-known writer Anatole France and Octave Mirbeau, the young assistant professor Victor Bache, the librarian of the École Normale, Lucien R., or the director of the newspaper Le Siècle, Yves Guyot. In this organization, Paul Violet, a Catholic jurist who wrote its bylaws, would mingle with Jewish Léon Blum or Jean Psychary, Calvinist presence or atheist Freemasons such as the historian Anatole Leroy Beaulieu and Arthur Rank, director of the paper The Radical. Even women, the journalist Severine or Mathilde Salomon, the founder of the famous Collège Sévigné, as well as many activists who were civil servants, pharmacists, or bistro owners, bourgeois, as well as anarchists. In 1903, Pressensé became the new president of the League. He was a socialist, and he progressively gave it a more definitely social orientation. He had been politically active in protesting the repressive blackguardly laws passed in 1893 after a series of terrorist attacks by the anarchists. These strict safety measures had made provocation of violence, possession of explosive, and conspiratorial association punishable by long prison terms. However, beyond the legitimate surveillance of some covert actions, this early French Patriot Act also allowed arbitrary detention, interception of mail, eavesdropping, profiling, and house searches without a warrant. Since then, civil rights, human rights, and social rights have been mixed together in the position of the League, as he's always tried to stand on the side opposing what they felt was unjust or arbitrary. This new comprehensive vision of what constituted the right of man, the human right, was stressed by his third president, Ferdinand Buisson, President Bush, who received the Peace Nobel in 1927 when he declared, there is another Dreyfus affair every time there is a defenseless worker, a child deprived of education, or a homeless man. In 1922, the French League united with the Belgian and the German Leagues to form the Fédération Internationale of the Rights of Man. And, of course, during World War II, the League was abolished, and its Jewish president, Victor Bach, the young man of the beginning, was executed by the Vichy militia. In December 1948, in Paris, however, the UN Human Rights Commission, with Eleanor Roosevelt as its president, proclaimed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was drafted very much by French jurist René Cassin, a man of honor of heroic proportions. He had been one of the first to join De Gaulle in 1940. He had drafted the chapter of the French Free Forces. He was a diplomat at the Society of Nations and the UN. He was one of the founders of the UNESCO. He became later president of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, and he founded the Consultative Council of Jewish Organizations. He received the Nobel Prize in 1968. In 1987, his ashes were brought to the Panthéon, near where had been placed exactly a century ago those of Émile Zola, another defender of tolerance, human rights, and democracy. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here. I take it you can all hear me? Right. Pardon my lack of a French accent. I will try. Thank you very much, Lorraine Bakler, for inviting me, and also the officials of the library. This is a great honor for me. There is lots of wires down here. Okay. There is a quip, a joke, that is occasionally repeated by historians that provides a somewhat unsettling entry into the subject of the Dreyfus Affair. If the line goes, in 1925, someone had said that within 20 years, close to 6 million Jews would be slaughtered in Europe the most plausible response after initial gasps of disbelief, this in 1925, might well have been to reply, "Ah, the French, will they actually go that far?" It's the anti-Semitic riots, the virtual pogroms taking place in every major French city in 1898 that no doubt underlies the sinister joke and explains the force, indeed the horrific aptness of the punchline, however historically erroneous it might have turned out to be. To which, I suppose one might add, all that is implicit in the subtitle given by the Israeli scholar Zev Sternhell to his important work about political thought in France in the years surrounding the Dreyfus Affair. That subtitle, you may recall, was not "The Origins of French Fascism," but "The French Origins of Fascism." If around 1900 you were interested in being a leftist, you'd probably go to Berlin. If you're interested in something a little bit odder, weirder, you would go to Paris, where the left and the right seemed to be meeting up, and that, after all, was fascism. The nightmare of 20th century Europe, viewed as an offshoot of the turmoil of 19th century Paris, such was, of course, the intuition behind Walter Benjamin's unfinished Arcades project, but such as well was the thought behind his friend Hannah Arendt's take on the Dreyfus Affair as a huge dress rehearsal for the genocide perpetrated by the Nazi regime. That's a quote, huge dress rehearsal. This being the year of the posthumous publication of an important collection of texts by Hannah Arendt, they're gathered as the Jewish writings of Hannah Arendt, I propose to take a look at the principal articulations of Arendt's reading of the affair as what she called a foregleam of the Holocaust, one which simultaneously offers a kind of foregleam of her own reading of the Nazi period in her book, a famous or infamous book, on the Eichmann trial called The Banality of Evil. By the way, already that choice by Hannah Arendt of the word foregleam in English, where most of us would probably say foreshadowing, bespeaks a certain attraction to the subject, shall we say. My sense is that Arendt's vision of the affair, like her vision of the Holocaust, is dictated by a fundamental allergy to the genre of melodrama. Melodrama, being the sentimental struggle of the forces of good against the forces of evil, is inherently manipulative of its audience. And it was precisely a reaction against such manipulation by the Dreyfusards that drove a great poet, Paul Valéry, or so he tells us, to contribute his gift, not without reflection, he said, to the anti-Dreyfusard cause. Now, the other of melodrama, the genre to which it is classically opposed, is, of course, tragedy, defined by Hegel as a conflict in which both sides are right. Thus, the disciple of Arendt, the philosopher Alain Finkielkraut, on the conflict in the Middle East as a tragedy in which the Israelis are right, but the Palestinians are right as well. This is not melodrama. This is tragedy. And perhaps the greatest problem is that too many people are willing to read this tragedy as a melodrama and frequently an anti-Zionist melodrama. In the case of the Dreyfus Affair, but also the Holocaust, the anti-Semites were so obviously in the wrong that there could be no question of invoking tragedy in which, as I say, both sides are right. The result is that Hannah Arendt's way of avoiding melodrama is to carve out a story or a genre in which both sides are wrong. I'm not sure we have a name for such a genre, perhaps satire, but I suspect the person who was most alive to its limitations was the great Israeli scholar Gershom Scholem in his letter of 1963 to Hannah Arendt on what he called the tone of her book, The Banality of Evil. The term he used to talk about her tone was the English word flippancy, a frequently, I quote him, malicious, almost sneering tone that might flare up in a phrase by Arendt, such as the Jewish Führer Leo Beck, who was the leader of the Berlin Jewish community. And more generally, in Hannah Arendt's thesis, you'll recall, brought a lot of criticism, that what made the Nazi genocide possible was not that the Jews had failed to organize, this is Hannah Arendt, but that they were organized and that their leadership, I quote, almost without exception, cooperated in one way or another, for one reason or another, with the Nazis, end quote. Now, let's see how that posture on Arendt's part, that absence of what Sholem called Ahavat Yisrael, a love of Israel, and she was proud, she said, not to have a love of either Israel or Germany or any people. Let's see how that manifested itself in her reading of the Dreyfus Affair. It would take us from the characterization of Dreyfus as a parvenu, which for Arendt was the ultimate put-down, kind of nouveau riche, to the mocking description of the Dreyfus family who, I quote her, in trying to save an innocent man, employed the very methods usually adopted in the case of a guilty one, that is, opening up their wallets, hiring out a publicist. And finally, it would take us all the way to a quotation from Bernard Lazare, the great hero of the Dreyfus Affair, the first Jew to stand up for Dreyfus. Quotation from Bernard Lazare to the effect that for the 36 or so Jews in France who were ready to defend one of their martyred brethren, you could find some thousands ready to stand guard over Devil's Island alongside the most rabid patriots of the country. Strong stuff. Arendt even goes so far as to quote André Foucault, not to be confused with Michel Foucault, André Foucault in 1938, characterizing the contempt of the Dreyfus family for unassimilated Eastern Jewry. I quote him, "The Dreyfuses of 1894, the year of the arrest, why they were anti-Semites." This is Hannah Arendt quoting André Foucault. By the way, I gave a version of this talk in the presence of the grandson of Dreyfus, who's still alive, who knew his grandfather. His name is Charles Dreyfus, and he's a vigorous and wonderful man. And I just felt I had to leave out that last quote. There are limits. Here then, in Arendt's castigation of the guilty victims of the Dreyfus Affair, is a foregleam, again her word, of the complicitous victims of the Nazi genocide in her book, The Banality of Evil. Of course, to make the link between the affair and the Holocaust stick, Arendt had to take matters out of the courtroom and see things as fundamentally political. And here her attention alights on a fellow named Jules Guérin, the leader of the Anti-Semitic League, and the stager of an unsuccessful coup d'etat against the Republic in February 1899. My friend Jean-Max Gueux was generous enough to bring with him a portrait of Jules Guérin. Why a portrait? It occurs on a postcard. The leader of the anti-Semites has his portrait on a postcard. This is something you might want to send to your friends visiting Paris. Here I am with the leader of the anti-Semites. Isn't it great? Wish you were here. It's right over there. When Jean-Max was introduced, our moderator forgot to acknowledge his extraordinary generosity, which I'll do that right here. Okay. Hannah Arendt tells us that Jules Guérin, don't take it out, please, it's going to crumble. maybe I'll show it from here, okay? This is more than 100 years old. Here's the postcard. Here is this stylish fellow. You like the mustache? And here's the carte postale. Jules Guérin, we are told by Hannah Arendt, we're all but told, would resurface as Hitler. I quote her, "The Jules Guérin had to wait nearly 40 years before the atmosphere was ripe again for quasi-military storm troops, end quote. As the vital link between the affair and the Holocaust, Guérin fascinated Arendt. He is described as the most modern figure of the anti-Dreyfusal, the stylishly louche or sinister denizen of the underworld in whom high society found its first criminal hero. Jules Guérin as prototype then, his legendary headquarters on the Rue de Chabrol, described by our author as the first of the brown houses, by which she meant kind of Nazi fortresses within a city. Except for the fact, I would say, that for any reader of Marx, the surprise is that Guérin's attempted coup d'etat seems less a prototype than a farcically weak echo of the already farcical 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. You remember Louis Bonaparte's coup d'etat against the Second Republic in 1851 that Marx wrote up as the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. Guérin, that is, may have been a dress rehearsal, répétition générale, for Nazism, as Arendt has it, but he represented no less a repetition of Marx's script for Louis Bonaparte's coup against the Second Republic of December 2nd, 1851. You may recall that for Marx, the specificity of what happened in France in 1851 was that the dialectic of class struggle between bourgeoisie and proletariat came to a sinister standstill as the lumpen proletariat, the dropouts of the class struggle, gathered around the eminently sinister figure of Louis Bonaparte, the nephew of the great Napoleon, and pushed through his imperial coup. To the shock of Marx, French history, he was in Paris at the time, writing for the Herald Tribune, to the shock of Marx, French history, which should have flushed away the dropouts of the class struggle, began to resemble nothing so much as a latrine backing up. All of these forces that were supposed to be flushed away were suddenly at the top of the French state structure. Here now is Hannah Arendt on Guérin's counterpart to the lumpen cohort of Napoleon III. I quote her, "The mob is primarily a group in which the residue of all classes are to be found." So Marx's lumpen dropouts and Hannah Arendt's residues, what she also calls déclassés, the dropouts. In Genuine Revolution, she tells us, the people fight for true representation. With the so-called residues, representation is beside the point. And just as Arendt's anti-Dreyfusar intelligentsia was said to have but recently emerged from a ruinous and decadent cult of aestheticism, she was probably thinking of an author named Maurice Barrès, Louis Bonaparte's lumpen proletariat was dubbed by Marx the whole amorphous, disintegrated mass of flotsam and jetsam the French call la bohème. Put that in your CD player and try to listen to it. Finally, just as for Arendt, bourgeois society, in its adulation of Guérin, had broken for good with its own standards, so for Marx had the bourgeoisie, in rallying to Louis Bonaparte, shown a willingness to sacrifice its own values, namely free speech, etc., in order to protect its economic privileges. In brief, for all her insistence on Tocqueville at the beginning of her long essay on anti-Semitism in the origins of totalitarianism, Arendt, in her unforgettable treatment of the Dreyfus affair, seems to be harking back to Marx's masterpiece on Louis Bonaparte, namely the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. It's in many ways his least Marxist book, and it's also his most successful book from my point of view. Unforgettable, the analysis. Well, I'd like to turn now to what strikes me as the most remarkable section of Hannah Arendt's discussion, and which nonetheless goes unmentioned in the historical critiques of her reading of the affair by the likes of, well, historians, distinguished historians like Michael Maris and Pierre Birnbaum. It concerns the notion that the Dreyfus affair, listen, begins, I quote, "not with the arrest of a Jewish staff officer, 1894, but with the Panama scandal, namely France's failed effort to build the Panama Canal." And it is the notion that the affair, before being a dress rehearsal for the tragedy of the Holocaust was the second act of a two-act drama that begins with Panama that gives Arendt's version of the affair its particular pungency. In a word, the Panama fiasco was France's big dig in the late 19th century. I come from Boston, so I know about scandalous big digs. I'm a little bit worried to see that as far away as Pennsylvania, you too know about the scandal of our big digs. So this French effort, failed effort to build the Panama Canal, under the leadership of a great man, of course, de Lesseps, the guy who gave us Suez. You know, this was going to be his next great success. It was one of those French catastrophes, a bit like World War II, that would be taken up and brought to successful completion by the Americans. It was, Hannah Arendt writes, a colossal racket, replete with payoffs and bribes, and in which French citizens were invited to invest, with the result that some 500,000 middle-class Frenchmen ended up in financial ruin. We have there a stock certificate that Jean-Max found in the attic of his family's home. It's probably worth a good deal as an antique, but I wouldn't try to cash it in for its face value. Now, the key element relating to the Dreyfus affair concerned the two principal intermediaries. This is important. The two principal intermediaries charged with bribing members of parliament, both of whom were Jewish. Their names were Jacques de Reynac and Cornelius Hertz. Eventually, Hertz began blackmailing Reynac, who committed suicide in 1892. Two crooks, one of them blackmailing the other. Reynac, under the pressure of the blackmail, couldn't take it. He committed suicide, but not before, and this is crucial, not before handing over a list of the parliamentarians and the journalists whom he had bribed, handing over that list to Edouard Drumont, the anti-Semitic leader, muckraker, and editor of the anti-Semitic newspaper, La Libre Parole, and he gave it to Drumont on one condition, that Drumont would cover up for Reynac personally. With remarkable cunning, Drumont released the names of the corrupted parliamentarians one by one, day by day, thereby building up suspense as well as the readership and the influence of his newspaper, which was principally an anti-Semitic rag. Now, the Dreyfus affair begins within the context of this Panama racket, a racket attributed largely to the Jews, even though there were no Jewish parliamentarians on Reynac's list. In Arendt's formulation, the Jews were but parasites on a thoroughly corrupt body, the French state, and thus available for scapegoating. Hertz, in the novelist Bernanos's phrase, was a parasite on a parasite. That is, he was a parasite on Reynac. Reynac, that is, was bleeding France, and Hertz was bleeding Reynac. Now, the image of Jacques de Reynac at the center of the physical swamp, the ethical swamp of Panama, was quite striking. We know that Reynac's closest associate at the end, the man who discovered his corpse, was his nephew, Joseph Reynac, the future Dreyfusard leader and hero. As for Cornelius Hertz, the guy who was blackmailing the chief crook, Cornelius Hertz, who appears to have been a world-class swindler, who was a friend of Thomas Edison and a man of genuine talent. I even found an article about him in Scientific American because he did experiments with electricity and he was taken seriously enough to appear in an article. A man who even served a stint as a physician on the staff of Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, until it was determined that his alleged graduation from the University of Paris was fictitious. Well, quite a guy, Cornelius. He married a Bostonian, by the way. I told you he was a man of talent. He eventually escaped Paris for England, where he declared himself too ill to return to France. In an interview unmentioned by Hannah Arendt, he declared that the reason he refused to return to France was that he had been accused of treason in the chamber, which meant that he could be tried behind closed doors and sent to Devil's Island. The interview with Hertz was published in New York in February 1893 in the New York Herald, the year before the Dreyfus court-martial. And in that interview, the headline described him as Hertz as a scapegoat. At which point, enter Captain Dreyfus, with all of his love of France, with all of his ideals, in the role, dare I say, of the schlemiel. By schlemiel, I mean the man who takes the hit for somebody else. One last item. Hertz's closest friend and protege, and Hertz's publicist, was none other than Georges Clemenceau, the future publisher of J'accuse, and Arendt's choice for the role of true hero of the Dreyfus affair. In sum, once one switches the perspective from dress rehearsal to second act, an entirely different affair emerges. The only thing comparable I can think of is something that happens in the Bible. And perhaps the rabbi can correct me on this if I'm wrong. Open up the book of Exodus, and you'll find the horrific enslavement of the Hebrews, of the Jews, of course. But if you go back a few pages to the end of Genesis, you find a description of the enslavement of the Egyptian feudal class through the wiles of Joseph, the court Jew, in the employ of Pharaoh during the years of famine. It's precisely the relationship between the Dreyfus affair and the Panama scandal. If you will, Panama is to Dreyfus as Genesis is to Exodus. I'll put it this way. The Canadian writer Mavis Gallant commented that she had been living for years in France, but it was not until she read a history of the Dreyfus affair that things became clear to her. As though up until then, she said, she had been watching television with the sound turned off. Now, presumably what she heard when the sound was turned on were those cries of death to the Jews during the riots of 1898. But there's a telling variant to that soundtrack. According to Bernanos, who was Drummond's self-proclaimed disciple and the principal source for Arendt, the patriotic bands of Jules Guérin, this photo you've seen here, portrait, those patriotic bands of anti-Semites would make their way during the affair down the Rue Montmartre to the offices of the newspaper L'Aurore, the paper where J'accuse was published, and the refrain they chanted made no mention of Jews. The refrain they chanted was, Panama, Panama. To summarize, the legacy of the affair may have been the Holocaust, but the affair itself was a legacy of the Panama scandal. And from the point of view of Drummond and the professional anti-Semites, it was Panama, I think, and not Dreyfus, that offered the perfect storm. For in the Dreyfus affair, it was their bad luck that they would be forced to deal with an innocent scapegoat, whereas in the Panama case, they had the luxury of dealing with not one, but two scapegoats, both of whom were guilty, Reinach and Hertz. Or to phrase things in comparative terms, I suppose this is as concise a formulation as I can come up with, there were two reactions to the French failure to build the Panama Canal. The American reaction was to build the Panama Canal. The French reaction was to give us the Dreyfus affair. Maybe I'll stop here. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you both for that really stimulating commentary on the Dreyfus affair and the consequences up until this day. And I want to start this conversation by asking you both, How did we get to the point that the voices, the faces of human rights are celebrities as opposed to the intellectuals? The intellectuals play such an important role in bringing to the world opinion the horrors of the Dreyfus affair. Where are the comparable voices today?
Hmm.
I think I have an explanation, which is sound bites. J'accuse is too long to read. Writers are too boring to read. And people want a 1 minute or 3 minute explanation on the evening news, and then we move on. And so in a way, that's what we are losing. Our intellectuals are disappearing in many, many ways. That's my explanation.
I'm not sure I have an explanation. There was a good book, and a surprising book, published by, I suppose, a French intellectual named Régis Debray a few years ago, called IF, meaning Intellectuel Français, French intellectual, suite et fin, continuation and end. And his sense was that the institution of the French intellectual had degenerated into an exercise in moral exhibitionism, telling the masses everything that they wanted to hear, whereas the people in the days of Zola, and even before Zola, mind you, there's a long critique of Zola, even Zola in the Dreyfus Affair, as though Zola had latched on to the affair when it was good for his reputation, and that the first man to really risk everything, who was Bernard Lazare, and who ended up on bad terms with the Dreyfus family. Why? Because Lazare said, look, this is a story about anti-Semitism. And the Dreyfus family said, shh, let's not talk about anti-Semitism. Let's not rock the boat. So there are, I mean, things were always already rather ambiguous. I would even say that in the case of Zola, that great celebrity, Zola's last book, last novel, it's not a very good novel, it's called Vérité, Truth, and it was an effort to transpose the story of the Dreyfus Affair to a different circumstance, namely the sexual abuse, rape, and murder of a little kid by a priest, the whole thing being blamed on a Jew. He has characters corresponding to every member of the Dreyfus Affair, and at the end of the affair of this boy, in which the Esterhazy priest, Father Esterhazy, if you will, is blamed, he bears a different name, Gorgias, at the end of all that, everything is turning just wonderful. France is becoming a utopia, and you know what he says, Zola, the hero of the Dreyfus Affair, he says there are no more anti-Semites. And you know why? Because there are no more Catholics. And you know what else? There are no more Jews. Signed, Émile Zola, everyone's favorite hero of the Dreyfus Affair. It's very strange, no? So that there are so many ironies and paradoxes. Can I just offer you one more, and then I'll... This is one of my favorite ones. If in the years before the Dreyfus Affair, you were a French officer and a Jewish officer, if you were a Jewish officer and you were insulted by Drumont or one of the others, the only honorable thing to do was to challenge him, your insulter, to a duel. That got complicated. Why? Because you had to find someone to officiate as a second for you. There was a guy who set up shop, had a concession, as a second for offended Jewish officers. His name was Esterhazy. You know him as the villain of the Dreyfus Affair. Before that, the message was, if you're a Jew and they're attacking your honor, the man who'll help you out is Major Esterhazy. The guy, by the way, who would put you in touch with Esterhazy, make the connection for you, because he was a good guy and he wanted to help the Jews, was Zadok Khan, the chief rabbi of Paris. Paradoxes galore. I mean,
did you want to comment?
No.
I'm going to exercise moderator's license and ask one more question before I open this up to the audience. This is a question that really goes to one of the key struggles that we're having within the Collection Advisory Committee. In fact, we had a discussion just earlier today. In the Beitler collection, there are many examples of the kind of really virulent graphic caricatures that were so much a part of creating the toxic environment for the Dreyfus affair. And we're really struggling with this question of how do we make this these images, make this material available so that people really understand the history, understand the context and the environment that gave rise to this injustice, at the same time that we address our concerns that this material will be misused, will be taken out of context, will be used in a way that does exactly the opposite of what we're doing by trying to make this story and this material understood by larger audiences. So, I invite the two of you to give us recommendations. I'm not going to ensure that we'll accept your advice, but we ask you for your advice and recommendations as to how to balance this tension.
Okay. Well, there is something which is enormous in what we are talking today. It's the Holocaust. I mean, you can make a joke about the Jews at one time, you cannot make the same joke after the Holocaust. If you see, for instance, you will see a few of them there, where, first, the French press at that time is totally free. You can write anything you want on anyone you want. You can show anything you want as a cartoon. It's allowed. Totally free. So in a way, when Zola dies, they will have representation of Zola carried like excrement, like a pig, with the word caca on it. This type of bad taste is normal in those caricatures, and the caricatures are there to make you laugh. And of course, if you don't like the Jews, you can poke a lot of caricatures of those Jews that you hang, that you kill, that you put out of France by the army or whatever. It's so funny. It's not so funny anymore. When you see those caricatures and when you see what those funny things became 30 years later or even 20 years later or even the year later in Russia, you realize that the humor of the time is something that we cannot accept. And so when you show those images today, they are 10 times stronger than you can think. And one of the problem, of course, is we show them on the internet. Who is going to look at them? For which reason? For what purpose? And personally, I think there are ways to lock the internet to show a small image like that and to say, why do you want to see more? Who are you? What is your purpose? I'm professor so-and-so from the university, blah, 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 and I'm trying to, or I'm a student, my name is, and I'm writing a paper on Jewish ears. We know why you are going to do that. But opening the net totally, maybe I'm too much French. You know that in France it will be forbidden not only to say this type of things, but also to sell. It's impossible in France to sell on the internet, on ebay.fr, some Nazi stuff. It's forbidden. You cannot even look at them. The screen is blank. So in a way, the French are more into Big Daddy or Big Brother telling you what is good for you and what is not. In America, we are more open, and you have the freedom of expression. And in a way, I'm still French in that sense. I like to regulate the system, and in a way, it's a form of censorship.
It's a difficult problem. I recall when I was an undergraduate, they used to show us in for one course the Leni Riefenstahl film, Triumph of the Will, Hitlerian Propaganda. And they always gave us afterwards footage from the liberation of Auschwitz as a kind of chaser. So maybe pedagogically one could do something like that. I don't think that this French approach of, well, I suppose the limit case is criminalizing the denial of the Holocaust. I don't think that that works. I think you create martyrs that way. There was a fellow in Canada named Ernst Zundel, a German who was a big Holocaust denier, and he went to trial, and he sported a baseball cap. And on the baseball cap, it said simply, free speech. And, you know, unfortunately, he had a point. I mean, there's a great risk that this sort of thing will be abused. By the way, free speech is the translation of the newspaper that brought us the Dreyfus affair, La Libre Parole. So there is a whole tradition there, though there are complications there as well.
I'm jumping on what you said at the end. There is today a party in France whose president is Mr. Le Pen, and their motto is exactly the same motto as La Libre Parole. It's France for the French. Mm-hmm. Now, he's not allowed to say a few things. If he says that, this is going to bring him a suit. So
if he says what, exactly?
For instance, he will say, you know, compared with the history of mankind, the Holocaust is just a detail.
Yes.
Sue me. The 100 years war is just a detail in the story of the world. He knows exactly what he is saying, but of course, you understand what you want to understand in what he says. Okay, his message is the same as La Libre Parole. They are still there.
Mm-hmm.
But the system is sort of taking them in their place.
But don't you think that there is now, as a result of such moves, a kind of Holocaust envy, which is abroad in the world, which is ultimately fueling anti-Semitism? That is, this sense that the more we talk about the Holocaust, alas, the more people feel that the Jews want a monopoly of suffering, and that the various other minorities feel that they, that their right to their own Holocaust is being denied. There is right now in France a very popular comedian, popular even with the middle class, named Dieudonné. There was even an article about him in the New Yorker about a year ago or so. And that's his line. And as a result of that, someone I mentioned, the philosopher Alain Finkielkraut, you know, has come up with the line that, alas, our insistence on talking about the Holocaust, on talking about the fate of the Jews, on talking about the suffering of the Jews, has ended up doing the opposite of what we hoped. We thought that the message would be, the lesson would be, never again. And the lesson has been, we want our piece of reparations. We want our piece of suffering. We've suffered just as much, etc. and so forth.
Okay, let's open this up to the floor, and I just ask people to be respectful of other people's questions and respectful of time. Yes, sir.
Yes, the is entitled Lessons from the Dreyfus and Zola. And where there are lessons, you assume there's learning, and where there's learning, you assume there's change. In lieu of the migration of Jews from France, what lessons have the French learned? Either member of the
panel. You say in lieu of the migration?
In view of the migration of Jews from France currently,
From the Dreyfus Affair?
No, currently.
Yes. No, but I mean, what have they learned from the Dreyfus Affair?
Yeah. Lesson learned.
Well, I mean...
Right.
I mean, the French have been obsessed with anti-Semitism for a long time. I mean, one of the unfortunate clichés of American journalism is that the French have never owned up to their anti-Semitic past. In fact, I believe they've wallowed in their anti-Semitic past, and that may be a problem as well. What have they learned? I mean, there are numerous lessons you could learn from the Dreyfus Affair, I suppose. One of the lessons is just how virulently attractive anti-Semitism is, or historically has been in modern times, as an ideology. At the time of the Dreyfus Affair, it was probably the only ideology that could unite both the right, for whom the Jew was classically the stranger, and the left, for whom the Jew was classically the capitalist. Someone like Maurras, a right-wing thinker but of great influence, said, we never suspected that it would be that effective. And it was providential. With anti-Semitism, he said, everything becomes possible. So there's a lesson, you know, that anti-Semitism works. I mean, there are many other things. That anti-Semitism is terrible. That you can victimize an innocent guy, that too. But Jean-Max, maybe you can...
Well, I'm French. I'm American also, but I'm French. And because I'm French and because I have my accent, you might believe me or you might not believe me. Usually, I find Americans, and especially Jewish Americans, believing that... because they read it in the book, anti-Semitism is rampant and it's such and such a problem that a lot of Jews are now leaving France. Well, I'm from a city called Marseille, in which one third of the population is Muslim, 10% of the population is Jewish in Marseille. There were riots everywhere. We never had riots there because we are not a melting pot in which everything is cooked, but more of a bouillabaisse in which every fish is cooked and keep its own juices and its own form and shape. And maybe because of this view, sometimes I'm trying to tell Americans and Jewish Americans that they are not leaving. I don't say there is a propaganda in America telling you that it's the return to the land. I don't know, maybe in Paris, maybe with Orthodox Jews who are going to Israel, but all the people I know in France are... And there are many Sephardic Jews, I must say, because in the south we had half of the Jews of North Africa after the independence of Algeria moved to France, and most of them stayed in southern France. The idea of going back to Israel or going to Israel is used, but I think they are telling you here more than it is in reality, from what I can tell. And if you go to the site in which I'm talking in Amherst, and someone is asking more or less the same question, and there are some French Jews who are attending the conference, and they realize that I'm not explaining well enough, and they move in to say, no, you are wrong. I mean, it's very difficult as a French person to convince you that it's not as terrible as they are trying to make it. Now, it must not be easy because anti-Semitism is still there. But, I mean, the lesson of the Holocaust has been spread a lot on the French themselves. Maybe some Muslims are feeling something else, but I mean, the night and fog, I mean, my generation has been brought into that. Maybe my grandfather was reacting the other way. I think we learned the lesson of fascism, anti-Semitism, I think the French, even if they like Jerry Lewis, are human like everyone else. They know what's wrong and what's bad. Now, on the other way, people don't know if I'm a Jew lover or not. And so the jokes are given to me as if I were open to the joke. This is what I was telling you. I mean, we have to stand up and speak up. I hear them, it's true, so it must be offending for a lot of people. But at the same time, I think it's not as strong and deep as it used to be. I mean, they have learned the lesson. I can assure you from my experience.
The Amherst references to a 90-minute video of a presentation that Professor you did at Amherst in what, November 2006?
Yeah.
November of 2006, and there got to be some rather tense exchanges there. So you can find that on the internet pretty easily.
Put my name in Amherst, and you will see the discussion, because there is a point where, what can I say? I mean, the people don't believe what I'm saying. So I cannot convince you.
This lady, yeah. And then you, sir.
How much influence do you think the American movies have had on the Dreyfus affair? I'm old enough to remember the Full Mooney movie, and this is how I really know of the Dreyfus affair, whether it was totally true or not, I don't know. Speak to that point, if you will.
Okay. I'm sorry. The movie was forbidden in France in 1937. It was forbidden because it was an insult to the army, and second, because remember, in the movie, the word Jewish is never pronounced once, and it was mainly also to defend the family of Zola. Of course, they made another movie after the war on the Dreyfus case. The movie wasn't shown either. It was only 5 years later that they finally showed it on TV. So you're right, there was a sort of a problem, but it's mainly because the army doesn't want to be stained and blah, blah, blah. It's the story about the statue of Dreyfus, which was supposed to be put in the middle of the École Militaire, where he had been degraded. And of course, at the last minute, the military said, no, 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 we cannot have that, just have a plaque somewhere. So it's more or less this sort of attitude. The army never swallowed until recent years that they made a boo-boo. I mean, it was a disaster. But they refused to admit it, I would say, until recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And Chirac was the first one to apologize.
Yes, sir.
They're trying to identify the sources of French anti-Semitism then and at this time and today. We have three usual suspects, the military, Palestine was anti-Semitism.
Can you speak louder, please?
Oh, you said trying to identify the sources of French anti-Semitism then and now. Of course, in the time of Dreyfus, you had the military who was evidently anti-Semitic. You had the Catholic Church who was fighting the Republic anti-Semitic. And you had the political right, Jean Drumont, Hugo Arrault, probably also the PNR in Algeria who presented the premier decree granting French citizenship to Algerian Jews. And now the military in France, you couldn't say that it's anti-Semitic, I guess it's much more professional, neutral, at least. The church today in France is certainly not anti-Semitic. You had after the Vatican II, after Jean Paul, the efforts to reconcile the Jews, after the rolling back the deicide charge against the Jews, and you have a bishop or a cardinal of Paris who is a Jewish descent. Now, the right, the political right, where you have now Le Pen is a French, he's not a French phenomenon, a French phenomenon. So, is there in France today, as we speak, a coherent, self-aware anti-Semitic ideology as a potent political force?
Yes.
And if so, what's the engine that's driving it, especially when you have a French president who is partially of Jewish descent and who is openly, assertively Jewish and openly friendly to Israel, unthinkable at the time of Dreyfus?
Yes.
Either gentleman or the
right. I think they both.
All right. A very rich question. First of all, to complicate your original premise, true that the military was obviously anti-Semitic at the time of the Dreyfus Affair, but don't forget that French Jews used to swear by the military. Why was that? Because who was it that emancipated the Jews? It was Napoleon and the French army. Do you know the Heine poem about the two grenadiers that's set to music by Schumann? My son used to play it on the violin. But the theme is that if ever the two French grenadiers saying that if ever Napoleon should pass by, they will emerge from their own graves to defend the emperor, the Kaiser, one more time. And that is preeminently, you see, a poem written by a Jew, by Heine. There were Jews who thought that Napoleon, who called on the Jews to come to Jerusalem and help liberate the Holy Land, they thought of him as the Messiah. And this accounts for the terrific pathos of the situation of this anti-Semitic army in the Dreyfus Affair. Also, the idea that the anti-Semitism was entirely, at the time of the Dreyfus Affair, a phenomenon of the right. By the end of the affair, we can say that. But at the beginning of the affair, the left was of the position that Dreyfus was a bourgeois. His enemies were capitalists. He was a rich capitalist. The line was, this is not our affair. As one thinker put it, it is true that Dreyfus is paying for somebody else. But how many people in how many sweatshops are paying for Dreyfus and his wealth? You see, that was the basis of a left-wing rejection of Dreyfus. Eventually, with Jaurès, things turned around. Right now, I would say that anti-Semitism has essentially changed in France. For a long time, for about 40 years, France had identified right-wing anti-Semitism as the nemesis. The nemesis which it had defeated, which it was defeating. But as in the opera, it was as though they wanted to keep on singing addio, 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 and sort of wallowing in the guilt of France during the war, and thank God it's now over. And the paradox is that just as the French were bidding farewell to right-wing anti-Semitism, or to anti-Semitism, its favorite bugaboo, exiting stage right, anti-Semitism made a surprising entrance stage left in the form of anti-colonialism, anti-Zionism, anti-racism, and it whacked the French intelligentsia on the back of its collective head. And I'm not sure that much of the French intelligentsia has recovered from that yet. But it's a big difference between the disappearance of right-wing anti-Semitism and the emergence of anti-Zionist, anti-colonialist, colonialist, anti-racist anti-Semitism.
No. Sir?
Yes, sir.
No, I don't see anti-Semitism as a widespread personal disease of the mind, in the sense that it can affect people from all kinds of political or social persuasion. If you go back a little while, there's a lot of anti-Semitic writing in Voltaire.
Mm-hmm. In Zola, and sometimes you will see some things which are remarks. Yeah. If I may jump in, is one of the reasons is that you heard me mention one of those groups called the LICRA, the International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism. And often people are saying, why? Isn't anti-Semitism racism? And the answer is, it's a different form of racism. If you listen to a racist, the fill the blanks are this, and that. We know exactly why those people that I hate are despicable. With the Jews, they play a game, and usually it will be something like, you know what I mean. They will never pinpoint what they are saying. It's so vague. Like la France au Français, France to the French. It doesn't mean anything. But that way I can take those people, I can take the Christians, I can take the racists, I can take the people who have a personal problem with one Jew in their life. And by having those innuendos, they can succeed and say adio and adio and adio, because it's a very subtle system.
I think this may need to be our last comment.
Yeah. I wanted to clarify what I meant by, and this complicates the issue, no? By anti-racist anti-Semitism. Sounds like a contradiction. Some time ago, in the Nouvel Observateur, it was reported a horrific case of a crime of honor in Jordan. A young woman from Palestine had been sent to visit her sister in Jordan, who was giving birth to a baby, in the course of which childbirth, or during that week, she was raped by her brother-in-law. She then called home and said, something horrible has happened. I've been raped, and I've been raped by my brother-in-law. I don't want to stay here anymore. They said, come back. When she came back, she discovered that in order to defend the honor of the family had commissioned her brother to murder her. Now, this is a horrendous story. It was not the whole of the story told by the moderate left weekly, the Nouvel Observateur. The story they told wanted to be more even-handed. I mean, this could set you into an anti-Muslim or an anti-Arab frenzy, perhaps. And so they told the following anecdote. And they said, the Israelis know about these crimes. And consequently, crimes of honor and these horrific punishments. And consequently, the Israeli army has initiated a policy of raping Palestinian women so that their families can finish off the job for them. An extraordinary statement and a false statement. It was a false statement made out of the spirit of anti-racism. We've said something horrible about one group. We now must say something equally horrible about the opposition. The only problem is that in the case of the opposition, it was false. So they eventually had to retract it. It did not help that the author of the article was Sarah Daniel, the daughter of the editor-in-chief of the Nouvel Observateur. But that's an example of anti-racist anti-Semitism. How else could you call it?
Unfortunately, we need to bring this this forum to a close. I please applaud our two speakers, Professor Hillman, and applaud themselves for allowing us to have such a rich and nuanced discussion here today. And I want to bring Marjorie Dugan from the advisory committee to conclude this session.
They wanted me to read a 20-minute speech, but I refused. I said, 1 minute is it. Just a couple things. First of all, I do thank everyone here, that all of you and our speakers and moderator. This was so exciting. The comments you both made were very different, but so stimulating. And, you know, I'm leaving charged with thoughts and questions, and I'm glad I get them for a little while afterwards tonight. Just a couple thank yous are in order. One is for Alida Arthurs, who is the event person for the university, and you're going to get to see the products of her work soon, because you'll get to go next door and eat the wonderful things you've been smelling for the past couple hours. I also would like to thank Lance. Lance is chair of the advisory committee, and at a time when we were trying to find our way here at the university, and we're just forming and just becoming an entity here at the university, Lance brought all the power of his respected offices and work at this university to the table and took over as chair of the advisory committee. And I'd like him to stand, because he's made a huge contribution. I would also like to acknowledge David McKnight, who is new to this role with Rare Books and Manuscripts, but he has been a true gift to the work of the advisory committee. And I wanted to thank you, David, for all you're doing on our behalf with your staff. You know, the message of the collection and the exhibit transcends time and place. And there's a universality of it that we've heard about in great detail today, tonight. And we clearly need, at this moment in time, we're desperate for people of honor, integrity, who believe in truth, who have an ethical perspective on the world, and they have courage. We need it in law, we need it in government, we need it in medicine, we need it in civic action. We need it with us, all of us, today. And I'd just like to finish with a quote by someone I have great respect for. I actually quit graduate school, and I'll date myself when I tell you this, to work on his presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. You might recognize these words. They're Bobby Kennedy's. Each time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others, she sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. I offer those as words of description of our curator, our collector, our friend, Lorraine Beitler. Go eat, converse, enjoy. There are good things to drink in there, too.